In December of 2011, I wrote a piece for the National Post concerning Attawapiskat. At the same time, I came across an article that was also making some similar points, and I got curious about who wrote it. Well, it took me some time, actually, to find out the identity of that person, but eventually I did, and I sat down and talked with her earlier today. Her name is Chelsea Vowell. She is a 34-year-old Métis mother of two girls born and raised just outside of Lac Ste. Anne in Alberta. She has a B.Ed. and a Bachelor of Law from the University of Alberta. Currently, she's teaching and living in Montreal, where she's also a big fan and participant in the new roller derby, the WFTA, or Women's Flat Track Derby Association. I'm a fan also. So we had at least a few things there to talk about. We sat down and talked about some big ideas, and here's how it went. You and I crossed paths, I believe, although we didn't mutually know this, that we had, but we both wrote on the same thing at the same time, which was Attawapiskat. And your article appeared in the National Post, attributed to somebody else through a series of errors. It was picked up and printed from somebody, not from you, and so their name was on it. You want to talk a bit, go back to that and talk a bit about that, how that all came about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Geez, I don't even know where to start. Like, when I saw it in the National Post, I was completely shocked because I hadn't given them permission to publish it, and apparently, you know, some dude had written it. So everybody was asking. Some people were actually, you know, a little, you know, the dialogue going on at the time was pretty poisoned, and so there was a short period of time there after my article sort of went viral on my blog, and then between the time that it was then posted on National Post, where people were starting to go, wait a minute, did you actually write that? You know, I had some people go, you know, suddenly feeling very suspicious, like maybe that I was, you know, actually some white guy pretending to be a Métis woman, right? There was some of that suspicion going on. That was a little bizarre. But for me, the sort of scary thing about it was that, you know, on my blog, I've been writing as under a pseudonym, and I had not really expected anybody to ever really read my stuff, because it was just a small linguistic blog, basically a small cultural thing. And all of a sudden, without, you know, being prepared at all, my real name got out there, because they made the correction. They figured out, you know, that I was the one who wrote it. And then instead of asking me, you know, if they could do this, they just published my name. And all of a sudden I realized, you know, I was going to have to deal personally with everything that I said, which, you know, I was fine with, but it was because the dialogue was so poisoned and people were just saying such hateful things, it was a little intimidating. And I actually did get hate mail. People tracked me down once they saw my name, found my email, and sent me some really horrific things.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you're talking to somebody who knows a thing or two about that. So
yeah, I bet.
I got that same hate mail for the same reason.
Yeah.
But was that why the pseudonym or writing under, not under
no.
your own name?
No, the only reason I was writing under a pseudonym is just because, you know, I was working at a law firm, and you know, some of the stuff that I was writing, you know, I just didn't want anybody like Googling me and then being like, oh, she's all opinionated and stuff, you know. You know, I was just trying to be a little conservative professionally at that point, you know. And I just, you know, it's a bit creepy. I don't want all these random strangers on the internet knowing who I am. I wasn't prepared for that. And then when it happened, I just had to deal with it. And in a way, it's nice, because now I know, like, you know, I stand behind everything I said under the pseudonym too. But now that, you know, when I'm out there and it's under my name, I'm saying that, and that's me. Like, people can hold me accountable for it, right?
Yes.
So I'm not worried about it anymore. But at the time, it was scary, and it was scary for my family too. They were really worried about me, just because they saw the, you know, how hateful people were getting, and they didn't really want me personally to be, you know, the target of that. But, you know, it's sort of the positives outweighed the negatives.
Yeah, and I can hear you trying to balance all these considerations, and I certainly appreciate that. It makes eminent sense to me. Now, the reason I went back to the National Post stuff and started there is because I think it's fair to say that's when people became aware of you. What was going on before that? How long have you been writing, by the way?
Well, I guess I started a few months before that, and maybe in May, and that article went viral I can't remember, December, yeah. And so before that, like, you know, I'd have maybe, you know, my best day, I'd have 100 people read an article. So I wrote that that article on my blog, and, you know, there were a few hits and stuff that night. But when I woke up in the morning, you know, it was crazy. There was like 30,000 people that had seen it on my blog already. Like, I was like, is something broken here? You know? And I just watched it steadily climb. And like within a day and a half, it was 100,000 people that had seen it on the blog. And then it was published in National Post. So I have no idea, you know, I have no way of tracking how many people read it there. But I think by the time it was on the National Post, a lot of people had read it already. It had really spread well throughout social media, which, you know, I'd never really seen that happen before. So it was, you know, this blog thing, I mean, it was completely new to me. I was not a blogger for very long, so I hadn't seen that sort of phenomenon before.
Now, for people who don't know, we should have started here, I guess, but let's describe your blog, Beatowee Ghostison. And for those of you out there who don't know Cree, and that would include me, you might have to spell that and give people the address, but or I can do that. But talk a bit about what it is, what your website is, and what you're trying to accomplish there, and what you do.
Yeah. Well, that's really changed. When I first started out, it was basically just an opportunity to talk about the Cree language. That's what I really started with. I'd noticed that I'd always been keeping track on the internet of Cree resources and things like that, and there really wasn't much for years. And then all of a sudden, just in the months before I started my blog, there was just this amazing like renaissance where, you know, even through Facebook pages and stuff, you suddenly had world-class linguists, you had, you know, elders, you had fluent speakers, you had learners, everybody coming together on the internet, sharing resources, asking questions, and just really like bringing the language alive in this way that I'd never seen before. I was really excited and I wanted to be a part of that. So I started my blog as a linguistic blog, basically. And then I couldn't help it. I'm a very political person. So, you know, something can happen and I would just start writing about those things. And I tried not to at first. I was like, no, I'm going to stay out of the politics. Right. It didn't last long. Yeah. But then it changed. When people read that article and I got so much feedback about it, and most of it positive, of people going, wow, I never knew about these things. Like, oh, you know, I was like, well, you know, really? You forget that people don't know these things. And so I was like, well, I want to be positive about it. I want to explain these things better. And I want there to be resources for people so that when they're in the middle of being attacked, you know, oh, you don't work. Oh, you're on welfare. You get your education free and stuff. They can just, you know, they can be like, boom, here's some information. Boom, here's some information, you know, and then just walk away. So that's my purpose, is that it's there as a resource for people to learn. And it's there as a resource for people who, at the moment of high emotion when they're being attacked, it's difficult to come up with a good argument and explain why that other person is wrong. I want that there for them, too, so that they can say, you know what, no, and here's why no.
Yeah, I was asked about your site, and the way I described it, it was like getting this wonderful, meticulous briefing note every day. I mean, when there's something going on, you go to your website, because I mean, I think this is an important clarification to make. Political, yes, politics, but what you're really doing is going out and you're getting the facts and you're just getting the things that people don't know and really need to know. And I think that's probably why your site does so well, because anybody can have an opinion, and they do. Anybody can, you know, say the things that they always say because they just think they know that. You go out and you do the research. Quite a bit of research too, I would say. And then you just say, here it is, and here are the sources, this is how I know this. Here's what it says. I'm going to quote it right from the Indian Act, or here's what RCAP says, or here's, you know, you go to the sources, you put it all together, it's there, it's organized. And I would think, based on what I've seen, the response to your website, I have to infer there's a huge appetite for that. People really want this. They really want to know what the facts are, not what so-and-so at the, you know, at the newspaper thinks.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, and that's the thing is talk is cheap, right? And, you know, the thing is, too, is mainstream media, it just does not have the time or the space to do that kind of research. And so when people, these are very confusing things. I mean, even if you're native, like, just untangling status is very, you know, it's difficult, because especially when they make changes to it. But, you know, people don't understand, and so they see these things coming up in news, and they're like, well, why is this? They have all these questions, right? And the comment sections, which have sprung up, you know, in all online papers now, that's where you see those questions being asked. Well, okay, so the story said this, but, you know, what about this? And the media doesn't answer that. They can't, right? They just don't have the time. And so what I do is I look at that, and I'm like, well, okay, I'm going to show you why, you know? And so, yeah, I've got classrooms using the articles. I've been reprinted all over the place. I can't even keep track anymore. But having the sources there for me is really important. It's not just because I had legal training, right? My style of writing, is very much informed by online political debates, where people don't just take your opinion as proof of anything. They're like, prove it, right? So everything I do, I'm like, and I'm going to prove it, you know? And then, if people can come back at me and after looking at those things and bring up something else, I'll discuss it, right? But if people come and they're just like, no, and they don't read it and they don't look at the facts or anything, I'm not there to entertain that kind of you know, pseudo debate.
Right. So, well, you touched upon something to which I want to transition, and I think this is very important to me these days. I'm thinking a lot about it, and that's the distinction between writing for a mainstream audience, which is what I do, and then writing for ourselves and having an internal discussion. And you glided very quickly over the fact that a lot of this is confusing to Ongwehoe as well, to, you know, Anishinaabe. Yeah. It isn't just the case that white people don't get it, or whatever terminology you want to use there. I meet all kinds of, you know, native people who have... I would say also, we disagree sometimes, and I get into debates because we don't always agree, or we don't. I think sometimes people have misconceptions. I was just reading in the newspaper about this. Did you see it? The Russ George thing, where they were dumping the iron tailings and
I
have to look into that a bit more. But it occurred to me that, and I don't think they understood this was going to happen, but it did occur to me, one of the misconceptions about us is that we're all a bunch of environmentalists, and, you know, right. And yeah, I always say to people, you obviously never looked at the grounds after a powwow. How much we care about being tidy and not throwing garbage around and so on.
Yeah.
But where I want to go with this is to talk a bit about, I mean, you're writing predominantly, I think, as you conceive it, for a non-Indigenous or, mm-hmm. you know, non-Métis, however you put it, audience. But I bet you that a lot of people are going there and learning who actually, you know, they didn't grow up. I had the benefit of growing up around people who could, you know, teach the history. This is where we came from. This is who we are. But do you have a sense of your audience and how many people are coming there? And maybe they're Cree and they just found out or something. I mean, this is what happens, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. I have a huge diversity of audience. I've got people, you know, and yes, mostly I'm phrasing it so that non-natives with no experience with native issues at all can understand it. But yeah, I have a lot of people that are native that come there and they're like, oh, I never really understood this either, you know? And it's no fault to them, because a lot of this stuff isn't taught. You know, I did an article, for example, about First Nations farming on the prairies, right? And I'd never learned this. This is something that I had learned, and so I researched it and I talked about it, because when I was growing up, the stereotype was that, you know, Indians can't farm. They're too lazy, right? You know, forget all the other examples of yes they can, right? But, you know, that was just one of the stereotypes I grew up with, and it was never, ever addressed in school or anything like that. I was, you know, 34 years old learning this for the first time. Even though I had picked up stories over my life of successful farmers, successful First Nations farmers, but I'd never really pieced it together that stereotype, you know, where that stereotype came from and you know, things like that. So people will read these things and be like, you know, I never learned that.
Yeah. And I think we're shy. I'm saying we, I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I have a sense people are pretty shy about this. Yeah. You know, Ongwehoe, as we call them, you know, the native people are, mm-hmm. we're going to get to this terminology stuff because it fascinates me, but they're a bit shy about saying, I'm not, and there's a lot of things I don't know, but saying, you know what, whether it's because of colonization, or it is because of colonization, the Indian Act, residential schools, there's a lot of people who didn't learn about, you know, who they are, where they're from, and so we probably need more people like you for ourselves, just to, you know, sit and talk amongst ourselves and sit down and say, you know what, it's confusing to Canadians a lot of times, because even we send mixed messages. Mm-hmm. Who we are, what do we want, what are we trying to accomplish, where are we trying to go? This is something I've been thinking a lot about, because you have this resource here, which is doing a great service, and I think it shows some of the opportunities that we have, not just to educate Canadians, because my feeling is Canadians should probably be educating themselves anyway.
Yeah, no, I
we shouldn't
agree.
Be doing that. We should be educating ourselves and talking mm-hmm. to our, it seems like a diversion sometimes, I guess is my point. It's exhausting having to explain something again to somebody, mm-hmm. you know, you guys, you don't pay taxes and you don't do this, and you're all on welfare and you're sucking the country dry, having to constantly be going back to these same points over and over again.
Well, for me, that exactly, it is exhausting, and I was sick of it. I was sick of doing it. And for me, when I started doing these articles on status and, you know, this and that, for me, it's like, I'm going to do the research, because these articles, I mean, sometimes it takes me 8 hours to do it, to put it together, do all the research. Sometimes it takes longer. So I do it. I do the work. It's there. I'm done. I'm not having that argument again. I will bring that link up and I'll say, read this before you talk to me. If you really, really like feel strongly about this and you want to argue with me about it later, read this first. And then, you know, if there's anything new, I'll discuss it, but I'm not rehashing those issues anymore. So I'm trying to systematically go through the myths and debunk them, and then just like, let's get past that, because we can't spend the next 100 years, you know, going over that again and again. Like, get up to speed, guys, and let's talk about something else.
Yeah, no, that's just it. I mean, you've put it very well there. We shouldn't have to do this now, but I do feel it's diverting from the important work of mm-hmm. people building up nations and so on. And I can tell you, as a Ganyangehaga Mohawk person, I mean, we're mm-hmm. divided and we've got lots of work to do to amongst ourselves. And there's a tendency always to, you know, talk about the Gichiyukimau, the government out there and all that sort of thing, and ignore our own needs and interests and so on. But I suppose I've been walking around this, skirting it, but let's talk about language. I've noticed we have some similar, what shall I call them, bugbears or something like that, aboriginal, that's or pan-aboriginality.
Right, yeah.
These words that are out there. I first came across the word Aboriginal in graduate school. Those were Australian Aborigine mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden my professor said, no, actually Aboriginal is what you're going to call the Métis and the Inuit and the First Nations.
Right.
And it just kind of happened. And 20 years later, or whatever it is, because that's how old I am, we're still using that term. And it's always kind of bothered me. And you feel that way too, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I try to make this clear in the blog, but it's so difficult. But when I use it, I try to use it anymore just in the legal sense, you know, when I'm referring specifically to how it's used in, you know, in the Constitution Act and stuff like that. But it's just a terrible word. It's not descriptive at all. And this need to, like, generalize and shove so many diverse cultures into, like, one group so you can talk about them. I don't think that's a real need. You know, I think that's a made-up need. So I definitely have a problem with it.
Yeah. But, I mean, the language is very personal for people. As I know a lot of people still say Indian, yeah. Which is interesting because I'm talking about, you know, Indian people.
Yeah.
A lot of Canadians think, oh, that's a terrible word, but I still hear it all the time. That's what people are saying.
I almost prefer it.
Yeah, I think, you know? I think if somebody did a poll, that would probably be the most preferred word over, say, Aboriginal, which you're right. Yeah. It doesn't identify anything. I don't think of myself that way. Yeah. I think of myself first as Ganyangehaga and Haudenosaunee and, only secondary as, say, native, or, you know, I'm a status Indian, so okay. But language is important because it really does, if you think about it, it really makes you clarify a lot of things in your own mind, doesn't it? You know, it's not just about what's a good label. It's about, you know, who are you and where do you stand on certain things? What's important to you? Can you talk a bit about, because you write a lot about these things. You've done whole big, enormous posts just on this.
Yeah.
So in 10 words or less.
Oh God. Right. Not too long. Well, I think that general words are useful in terms of talking, you know, expressing solidarity with people who have similar experiences, right, of colonization and you know, some of the losses that we've experienced and also, you know, some of the amazing strengths that people show in the fact that we're still here, you know. And so, you know, when I like the term native. I think native is a good inclusive term, and I know a lot of people don't like it, but just among my friends and I, that's how we talk about ourselves. We're native, right? Now, in more specific terms, we all know who we are, right? Like, I'll express that I'm Métis, and that doesn't mean I'm Métis from the Red River settlement either. I always say where I'm from. I'm Métis from this community specifically, and that means something. That means I have a specific culture, specific history. That's where I'm from. And most Native people that I know also identify themselves first by where they're from, right? I'm from this community. I'm Nehiel from this community. I'm Cree from this community, or I'm Dene, or I'm Stoney, or whatever, right? And so it's not Native people usually using those really general terms first. That comes later, right? That's when somebody looks at you blankly because you've used your language's name for yourself, and they're like, what does that mean?
Sure.
Well, it means I'm Native, right? but I think it's really, really important that non-Native Canadians start to learn our names. You know, when they're living in these territories, I think they should know who the Indigenous people are, you know, around them are, and learn those names. And I don't think it's terribly onerous to ask them to do that. And I think that it would help non-Native Canadians locate themselves better, you know, in the territories, to understand those names and understand the power that those names have, because those names are not necessarily meant to exclude. And say, you don't belong here, get out of here, you know, not always,
yeah.
You know, but I mean, like, if you just call everybody Native and think of everybody the same, that you don't take any time to learn that the cultures are different and the expectations are different. And you know, if you're from outside and you're living on the territory, the obligations that you have are going to be different depending on whose territory you live in. Right. And I think the name starts first. I think when you know the name, then you can start realizing that the culture is important. Learn about it. It's different. It's not the same on the West Coast. It's not the same on the East Coast, you know? So yeah, to me, it has enormous power.
Yeah. Well, we're both writers and we pay a lot of attention to language, and it reveals and conceals quite a few things. You just said something which is very controversial among Mohawks, and that was the phrase non-native Canadians. I know lots of people who are very scrupulous about never using that phrase. I think I know what you mean. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, you know, Canadian, you're either Canadian or you're, you know, which side of the two row is it? You're either Canadian or you're not.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's just an example of some of the internal discussions and disagreements that people have within a community.
Right. And the thing is too, of course, like my language changes depending on who I'm talking to, right? I can say things when I'm talking to other native people and I don't have to clarify, but I'm so used to talking to non-natives that I really like, I try to be specific in a way that, you know, cause I've had people come after me, for say, you know, they're like, well, when you say Canadian, do you mean like new immigrants too? And who's Canadian anyway? And I'm like, I don't really care. But I'm just trying to say, you know, like there's this group and then there's all these groups, you know? Yeah. So it's always problematic. You know, you're always going to have someone picking at it.
Yeah. You could end up, maybe I'm taking us a little too close to that, but you could really end up in quite a big mess of philosophical discourse. I don't want to get too deep here, but I think if you're somebody who's thoughtful, then you have struggled with all of these things. The thing that I guess at the top of my list these days of things that I think about is how clear we can be, because one of the problems that we're going to have going ahead, whatever happens in this country, is we have to be clear. We have to be clear about, you know, where we're trying to go. And Canadians, you know, I sympathize with Canadians who are thoughtful and they really want to know, but they look at the across the country and they're like, well, where do we go? What can we possibly do here? Mm-hmm. And there aren't a lot of leaders out there who I think are really clear and honest and candid about some of these fundamental issues we're talking about here, you know, the Canadian one is a perfect example. Are you Canadian?
Right.
Or are you a distinct nation? And if you're a distinct nation, it seems to me certain things should follow from that. Mm-hmm. Your values and if you're trying to be both, it puts Canadians off. And I think there's good reasons for that, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Is that too general?
But I think too that you've hit on something important there is Canadians will look across the country at different native leaders, and you know, there's a lot of vague things being said about sovereignty and this and that, and some people really hate the word sovereignty, you know, and other people love it, and there's all these problems with the different ideas about this. But then what Canadians are looking for is some sort of unified voice, right? Which I think is unrealistic, and I think we have to get past that as well, because you're going to have, like, the Mohawk perspective is going to be very different than, you know, the Cree perspective from the Plains, even the Cree perspective from Northern Quebec, you know, and so people want to do things differently, right? And if everybody's looking for some sort of unified way forward, then they're missing what's really hopefully happening in the background, which is people are trying to decide for themselves. You know, and ultimately, that's what we want. We want people to be able to, different nations to choose for themselves how they're going to deal with things, right? And there's some commonalities, but there's also a lot of differences. And for me, the danger of, like, the whole pan-Indianism and whole pan-Métisism thing is that we forget that, you know, it's not so important to have a, you know, a unified front on that. I think it's more important that the unified nature of it is that we should be able to choose individually, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. And just to kind of wrap up this theme, pan-Aboriginality, yeah, I mean, I've been to communities now where there's been so much colonization and, you know, what the church has done and so on, that I feel for them, for people in that position, because the traditions of the longhouse and so on, they're still very much alive, and I had a very definite sense. But I can see why pan-Aboriginality appeals to people, because it may be all they have is powwow dancing and you know, and a few other things that are associated with pan-Aboriginality. So I used to look at that and think, oh, you know, that's terrible. Then I actually went out there and, you know, traveled and went to places and met people. And I guess my feeling now is, excuse me, my feeling now is, okay, well, I get it. I understand this has, it does have a value, and maybe it's empowering and maybe even therapeutic. It's not what I think of certainly as, you know, who I am or where I'm from. It is, and you're right, there's definitely a Mohawk perspective on things. Actually, we don't agree either, but there are some ideas that I haven't really found elsewhere. There may be in a couple of places across the country, you know, northwestern Ontario, where the culture around the pipe and so on is very strong. And out in BC, when I went there, I noticed very sharp similarities. But outside of that, we seem to be weirdos and oddballs. But
we love you for that.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'm talking way too much, but the point I was trying to conclude with is that, I'm looking forward to these discussions about clarifying just what you were saying, you know, what do we want and so on, and where do we go? And it seems to me that it's very hard to get those started. Mm-hmm. It's happening, but it's not really to the degree I'm hopeful to see.
But there's just incredible obstacles to having those discussions too. We're so focused on a lot of the communities are just so focused on, you know, day-to-day survival. How do you have those big idea discussions when you don't even have water that you can drink? You know, when you've got changes being made unilaterally to the Indian Act, you know, last minute, you know, really important changes, you know, things like that. I think that we're constantly put in a position to react, and we're constantly reacting just to survive. And so getting past that point to be, you know, safe enough to have, you know, the big idea discussions, it seems impossible. You know, and the communities are divided in how to respond to the challenges that are coming, the obstacles that are there, and that's where all the focus goes. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. But I feel like we've got to get some of these obstacles out of the way first. And they're just, you know, I picture these boulders just rolling down the path towards us, right? You know, like a video game, trying to jump over them and dodge them, right? We can't do anything but that right now. And for me, that's the most frustrating part of it.
Yeah. So you're going to keep writing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not writing as much as I'd like to right now because I'm working full time. But I'm going to keep, you know, I have a list of things, of myths to bust, right? And then once I get past that, then I want to personally get into the, you know, the bigger idea things. But
so you got a list of things you want to do. Looking ahead.
Yeah.
And I mentioned you live in Montreal. You're with the Roller Derby.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of the Roller Derby. Love the new skids. It's a great it's a great league.
Yeah, it's great.
Really, a really athletic league. I was really impressed by how quickly they came up. I don't know if people out there are paying attention to this roller derby stuff, but it made a comeback about 10 years ago. In fact, the Montreal was the first league in Canada. It was started up by her player name is Georgia W. Tush.
Mm-hmm.
She started the Montreal Roller League. They put together a few really good teams. The Filles du Roi was really, they're rebuilding now, but they had an amazing team for a while there. And it's a really exciting thing. This grassroots sport. Well, you talk about it a bit, how that works.
Yeah, well, that's what appealed to me about it is that, you know, it is very grassroots. It's it doesn't, you know, it takes itself seriously in all the right ways and none of the wrong ways. You know, it's very athletic. I like the fact that it's very inclusive. You've got women, you know, from of all ages out there, like, you know, the from 18-year-olds to, you know, I've met some grandmothers who do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and women of all body shapes and everything and from all walks of life. And they just come together and just work really hard and have a lot of fun while doing it. So you know, a lot of people just think it's campy and stuff like that. And yeah, it is a little campy. It's people getting together and having fun and pushing themselves far beyond where they thought they could go. So for me, it's incredible because, you know, when I went into Derby, for the first time in my life, I felt like an athlete, you know, before that I wasn't really into team sports and stuff like that. But this is team sports in a totally different way. It's so encouraging, you know, like it's the kind of sport where somebody, you know, knocks you over really hard and you go flying and you're like, great hit, you know, or you're excited for them because they hit you so hard, you know, like it's just really positive. So, yeah.
I grew up with the roller derby. I'm that old. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a somewhat personal connection to it. My aunt Jean Porter was in the original roller derby. Yeah.
And, scary. Those ladies are crazy.
Well, back then it's a flat track now. Back then it was the bank track and the men and the women both came out and it was co-ed. And typically you'd have a period or whatever, the men and then the women would come out. But yeah, it was pretty, she tells me about how it worked. I mean, it was serious business, right? Because back then it was for profit and it was run like a top down. So she would just, that would be her day every day. She'd just get up early and they'd have these crazy workouts and everything. But there you go, a Mohawk and the roller derby.
Yeah. Well, Ganawaga has a league now. They've started up. I know they've got quite a few. I picture an all Mohawk team and I just shudder. You know, talk about intimidation. It'd be great. So, yeah.
So what's planned for you? You're going to keep writing and keep teaching?
Yep. Yeah, right now, I'm working with Inuit youth right now. I'm really, really, really loving that I've gone back into teaching. Doing law was good. It was an eye-opening experience. And, you know, I'll keep continuing, my legal studies and legal work, as necessary. But it's such a slow and ponderous and an awful process. You know, I don't believe in it. I don't think that it's, that's what's going to get us anywhere, but it's good to keep on top of it so that I understand what happens when new changes are made. But, I'm definitely going to keep teaching and writing as much as I can, which unfortunately lately has, my time has been very limited, but.
And I should mention, you have your website, a blog. Do you call yourself a blogger? You're blogging?
people call me that. I don't call myself a writer because I'm not getting paid to do it. So.
Oh, well, you shouldn't. That shouldn't matter. And you also write, I'll mention here, for Rabble and the Huffington Post.
Yeah.
So you can be found there now under your own, under your name, Chelsea.
That's
Vowell.
Right, yeah.
you've been exposed.
I know, it's no going back now. Can't go back into the closet.
Yep. So with that, I want to thank you so much. This was amazing. And we could have talked about so many more things, but I think you've got your work cut out for you. You're going to be busy. You're not going to run out of things to talk about anytime soon.
No, for sure.
Well, thank you again, Chelsea. And I'm sure I'll see you here in the neighborhood at some point soon.
Awesome. Thanks.